We continue on this morning in our study of church history, and we encounter, I'm scanning for intelligent life forms, actually. Some of you know what that is, and the rest of you are going, what? We come to a portion that some people just find absolutely, impossible to understand, and other people find fascinating, and at the very least, it doesn't really bore too many people to death, and that is the subject of mysticism. There is always an element of mysticism. There's always a, at any point in the history of the church, you can find some sort of a fascination with mysticism. And of course, the term itself is rather vague. Generally, as we refer to it here, we're referring to that mysticism that flourished in the Middle Ages, in the Scholastic period. Actually, not the Middle Ages. It would be more the what I would call the pre-Renaissance period, up into the Renaissance itself, and it really survived into the time of the Reformation. And then once you have Reformed or Protestant churches, there's almost always been eventually a mystical movement within almost any one. The Lutherans have had people who become somewhat mystical. I suppose some looking down through the corridors of church history would even view some of elements of the charismatic movement as as having connections within mysticism. And basically, when you refer to mysticism, especially in the section we were looking at here in church history, it's generally perceived to be a reaction against what was understood to be a cold, dead orthodoxy. A cold, dead orthodoxy. So when you have a period of time in which there is an establishment of a orthodox perspective, for example, in the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries, you have the establishment of scholasticism. And while there are still people today who find reading Thomas Aquinas or Anselm fascinating, most folks find reading Thomas Aquinas and Anselm absolutely petrifyingly boring. And they don't find there to be any connection between what he is saying and what their life is like. And certainly for most people that was the case. I mean, when you think about it, most people were living on a small plot of land just trying to survive. During this period of time, for example, the plague sweeps across Europe. And that obviously, if you think 9-1-1 made America more religious than it's been in a long time, can you imagine if one-third of our population, not 3,000 people, but would be one-third, is, how many Americans are there now? About 300 million, somewhere around there, huh? Yeah, 300 million. So 100 million people were wiped out in just a couple of years. That, in essence, is what happened during the course of the plague in Europe. And that really tends to have tremendous impact upon one's worldview, upon one's religious perspectives, and so on and so forth. So at this time period, you're not going to, when the plague comes through, you're not going to find Aquinas to be overly satisfying, shall we say. And so there is a desire to find something more, a direct connection with God, in essence. And many people then and to this day really see orthodoxy as a dead end, especially if it has been passed on to you as something just simply given to you, and you don't have a vital, deep desire for that truth. Your parents may have had it, but you don't, or your grandparents maybe, and your parents were lukewarm about it, and now you can care less. You know, there's all sorts of ways it can happen, but in essence, you look at that orthodoxy, and it's like, this doesn't mean anything to me, it doesn't warm my soul, and since that's what's always been believed, and I see people who hold it who I don't want to be like, now I'm going to go look someplace else. And so what am I going to look for? Well, at this period of time in European history anyways, there really wasn't much else to look at. I mean, it wasn't a pluralistic society. You didn't have the chance to, you couldn't pull a John Walker and have, you know, run off and join the Taliban someplace, though there would have been folks similar to the Taliban off to the east. Generally, you that wasn't really something that was an option. And so you still looked within, quote-unquote, Christendom, because that's all that was available to you. But you started looking at other elements of it. And there were always mystics. And in general, people who became, from the established church's perspective, unbalanced in that direction would be, you know, put away someplace and kept quiet. But some of them were so either unusual or immensely pious in their actions and their life that they became extremely popular and became very popular figures. People would travel from many, many, many miles away to obtain wisdom and counsel of these individuals, so on and so forth. Many of these people sought, the term that was used was ecstasy, in essence an altered state of consciousness, a direct connection with God, an almost out-of-body type experience, visions and that kind of thing. TBN did not invent it. I can guarantee you that. It was has been around, and in fact is part and parcel of many of man's religions. There are many of man's religions, especially Eastern religions, that specifically inculcate. They're specifically designed to bring about an altered state of consciousness, and so they would these mystics at this period of time would seek visions. And, of course, much of the literature of the period, the pietistic literature, is filled with the various visions of the saints. And, in fact, the surest road to sainthood upon your death was to be able to have claimed certain miraculous visions and insights and things like that. I mean, just simply living a quiet, godly life was not exactly going to get you recognized by the church and added to the roles of the saints. As I mentioned, some of the reasons that mysticism spread, there was a tremendous corruption in the church. Aside from scholasticism, there was tremendous corruption in the church this period of time. There was a large amount of nepotism. You would find many situations, this continued quite literally for hundreds of years, where if you're you're an archbishop someplace, and you have control over a certain area of land, and there are five major cities under you, and each one of them has a bishop. You would appoint as bishops of those cities your relatives or your friends, and you'd work out, since the bishop made a good deal of money, because, again, there was tax revenue to be had. Remember, the church and the state are joined together, and so there was state taxes and church taxes, but they're all sort of rolled into one. So you could, for example, make friends by, you know, appointing such and such a person as a bishop, but under the table you would arrange to get X amount of his normal income. I'll make you bishop if you'll slide me, you know, 3.5% of your annual take from where you're at, and da-da-da-da. So there's a tremendous amount of corruption, and it wasn't really kept all that hidden. It was a general knowledge amongst most folks, including the lay people, that there was a tremendous amount of corruption in the church. Your priest might allegedly be a celibate man, but it was generally and widely known that most priests had concubines, sometimes more than one. And being a child of a priest was really nothing unusual at all. Erasmus, the great humanist scholar in the end of the 15th, beginning of the 16th century, was a son of a priest. And that was not unusual at all. And so even to the level of the papacy, it was well known prior to the Reformation that the papacy was in a horrible state of disrepair. In fact, during this time, you have what we're going to look at a little bit later, the great schism in the papacy and what's called the Babylonian captivity, where in the 14th century the papacy moved from Rome. Rome was no longer the seat of the very chair of Peter. It went to Avignon, France, and was there for quite some time. And then a rival papacy was set up in Rome, and they were busily excommunicating each other. And then a third pope was elected at the Council of Pisa, and then they all sat around and excommunicated each other. And finally, it wasn't until the Council of Constance in 1415 that the papacy is healed and brought back to Rome. And this likewise deeply impacted the thinking of people, that the church itself is rent and split, and some people thought it was the end of the world was coming because of this particular situation. So there's a tremendous amount of corruption in the church, and scholasticism was not exactly something that would give you a lot of emotional feelings. What are some of the key personalities? Well, you may have heard of Catherine of Siena. Her years are 1347 to 1380, so she only lived to be 33. She first joined the Black Mantles, an order called the Black Mantles, an ascetic group that beat themselves daily. In fact, they whipped themselves daily. That was what set them apart, is that they would take whips and they would whip themselves daily. And self-flagellation was something that was common at this period of time as an act of contrition. During the plague, many groups of ascetic monks tend to sort of die off after a while, but you would see groups of ascetic monks wandering about the countryside whipping themselves as doing penance to try to avert the wrath of God, because they saw the plague as a sign of the wrath of God, and therefore let's beat ourselves senseless and try to make God happy, as if somehow that was how things should be done. So she first joined the Black Mantles. She devoted herself to prayer, lived the life of an ascetic, and ministered to the sick. She was best known for the fact that she wrote a tremendous amount of letters. And as her fame spread, then her letters began to be collected. And it was sort of a snowball effect. And in those letters, she tells about how supposedly Christ appeared to her and asked her to be his bride and gave to her a ring. And this was a supernatural engagement ring, in essence. And so since she was so blessed to have been asked by Christ to be his bride, then she asked for the stigmata. Now, just for my own benefit, how many of you know what stigmata are? Well, let's make this a little bit easier. How many of you don't know what stigmata are? Okay, so that's about one-third know and about two-thirds do not. Stigmata comes from the word used in Galatians by Paul, where he says, "I bear in my body the marks of Christ, the stigmata." And to this day, it was back in the 1950s that Padre Pio was real popular back east, a Roman Catholic priest and monk who allegedly had the stigmata. So stigmata have been a part of mystical experience for quite some time. Allegedly, they are the marks of the nails in the hands, the nails in the feet, and sometimes the crown of thorns on the head, to where people swear up and down that these individuals would bleed from their hands and from their feet, and sometimes, as I mentioned, even from small cuts on their heads. You can find all sorts of literature. The official church plays down most modern versions of this. Rome's standard procedure for quite some time has been to play down modern examples, ever since the Reformation, for example, let a few hundred years pass, and then sort of take the lid off and allow stuff to grow. So St. Francis of Assisi, people like that, they're safe to allow people to believe fully that they had the stigmata, and that the stigmata are a evidence of one's close relationship to Christ, that you become so much like him that you actually begin to bleed like he bled, and that you'll develop these, in essence, sores or places on your body in the same places where Christ was wounded, sometimes even the side, by the way, from the sword thrust, will just bleed all the time, that they never heal up because these are the signs of your close union with Christ. And St. Catherine of Siena asked specifically for the stigmata, so that this would be a sign of her close union with Christ, in essence. And so she was very famous because she went to Florence and negotiated a peace between Florence and Avignon, which wasn't exactly something that women normally did in that day and time. And she also entreated the Pope to bring the papacy back to Rome. This, at this point in time during her life, it was in Avignon. And she survived an attack of smallpox, which was taken by some as evidence of a miraculous thing as well. Okay, 74 is getting a little bit up there. Slow it down. Thank you. And she was canonized, and canonization is something a lot of folks have been talking about a lot during the past, this current papacy of John Paul II, because he has been a regular saint-making machine. John Paul II has been cranking out saints right and left, has just absolutely filled the calendar up. I mean, I think you can start going to a three-year saint calendar now. I mean, it's just, there's so many, you can assign a saint for almost everything now, you know, saint for your mouse, your keyboard, your computer, the whole nine yards. And you need to understand, to canonize someone does not, the church, from Rome's perspective, does not have the power or authority to make someone a saint. They are proclaiming that in the church's view, this person was a saint. A saint, by definition, is a person who dies in the state of grace, who has more merits than is needed to offset any temporal punishments of their sins. In other words, they don't have any temporal punishments for sins that remain. They have more merit than anything negative in their life. And so if you die and you don't, and you have more merit than you have temporal punishments of sins, you get to skip purgatory, because that's what purgatory is for. Purgatory is for non-saint Christians. Purgatory in Roman Catholic theology is for people who die in a state of grace, but you have more temporal punishments on your soul required of you because of your sins than you have merit to balance them. So you have to go to purgatory to be purged and have those temporal punishments removed before you can go into the presence of God. But if you die with more merits than temporal punishments, then you go directly into the presence of God, and you're a saint. And the extra merit that you might have, and it might be just a little bit, or it might be a whole lot, goes into what's called the treasury of merit, and is then available to the church to dispense in the form of what are called indulgences. And you may be somewhat surprised to know that indulgences are still the theology of the church, but they actually are. So anyways, when the church canonizes someone, John Paul II, as I mentioned, cranking out saints right and left, that is not, that has no effect upon the person. The person was a saint, was it, whether they were or were not a saint was determined when they died. Where they went directly in the presence of God is determined when they died. The canonization process is a human process whereby the church recognizes these individuals as worthy of recognition as saints, and I'm not actually certain. I would assume, but I'm not actually certain about this. It would be an interesting question to ask, whether the charism of infallibility adheres to those to the church's decisions, or whether the church may have, well, historically it's a fact that the church has canonized people that she had to uncanonize later. But there's always a way around those. The church has canonized folks that further revelation or further research discovered weren't quite up to that standard, shall we say. So it would, I think for most people, they would be somewhat concerned about the idea that they may be praying to someone who actually is in purgatory and is in need of their prayers, not the other way around. But in general, most people would believe that the church's statement is a valid and true one, and hence those people that are listed as being saints actually are in the presence of God and hence can hear our prayers and intercede for us and so on and so forth, as the Roman Catholic perspective is wont to do. So she was canonized as a saint, and then in 1960, in the 1960s, she was made a doctor of the church. She was the patron saint of Rome, and she was made a doctor of the church. Now, there haven't been all that many doctors of the church. Thomas Aquinas, of course, so is one. Alphonsus de Liguori, doctor of the church. These are special, special people who are recognized as having had a really deep impact upon the church itself. And hence, Catherine of Siena becomes very much a part of the mystical literature that anyone would get involved in reading. Another was Meister Eckhart. His years are 1260 to 1327. He is the father of German mysticism. Eckhart was a powerful preacher. His theology was heterodox. Many of the mystical people had a very heterodox theology because what would you think would be one of the first things that would go out the window once you start having visions of Christ asking you to marry him and various sundry things like that? Well, obviously, any kind of standard norm of theology, sola scriptura, of course, had been gone a long time ago, but as far as these folks are concerned, but more so than that, even from the Roman Catholic perspective, the teachings of the papacy and so on and so forth would eventually become subject to your own personal experiences. And no matter what external authorities there are, they can always be subjected to your own personal experiences, which happened much in mysticism. He distinguished between God and Godhood. Godhood is simple essence having in itself the potentiality of all things, and so he was almost a pantheist or a panentheist. He had some very weird ideas, but the very fact that here would be somebody who is ascetic in their lifestyle, passionate in their teaching. It's almost similar when you look at this period of time and someone who would be preaching in the form of a Thomas Aquinas, very similar to the Pharisees of Jesus' day. What was the constant comment of people in the Gospels? When Jesus begins to preach, wow, how unusual. He speaks as one who has authority and not as our scribes and Pharisees. He speaks as one who knows these things. He's not just simply repeating, Rabbi such and such said to Rabbi such and such. That gets really boring very quickly. And the same situation goes on here. One of the most famous, and it is interesting, I've noted a fascination with these writers amongst Protestants very frequently. One that you may have heard of is Thomas a Kempis. His years 1380 to 1471. So he lived quite an elderly person. 1380 to 1471, he wrote The Imitation of Christ, which is commonly distributed to this day. He wrote that the goal of all life is to serve Christ in humility. He founded the Brethren of the Common Life, and his writings had an impact on both Luther and Erasmus. At the time of the Reformation, he's probably one of the mystics that had the most impact on a pietistic or experiential level on the Reformers than anybody else did. Fascinating fellow. Entire books have been written about this fellow that if you like, you know, high high tension and high adventure. Actually, here would be a historical person that would fit into those categories. Savonarola, 1452 to 1498. So he was only 46 when he died. He was a Dominican monk in Florence. He had visions and would relate the content of these visions. And the church didn't have a real major problem with that unless those visions required you to say things about the church. And these visions did require Savonarola to attack at first abuses in the church, a lack of spirituality in the church, and of course when that doesn't get an overly warm response from the church itself, which it generally wouldn't, then the rhetoric increases in its warmth, shall we say, so that he eventually attacks the church as a whole and even the papacy, and questions the validity of the papacy and the authority of the papacy and so on and so forth. An ordeal by fire was arranged, and if you have ever heard of an ordeal by fire, the popular belief was that if you were innocent of a crime, especially of heresy, that you could survive an ordeal by fire. But if you were guilty, then your guilty feelings would, in essence, make you less flame retardant, I guess. That's the only way I can really put it. Basically, a obstacle course would be set up, made up of flaming piles of wood, in essence, sort of almost a maze, but it was a maze on fire. And if you could make it from one end to the other end without dying and without being turned into a crispy critter, then that evidenced the fact that you were innocent. But if you were overcome by smoke or the heat or whatever else it might have been, you know, if you've been eating too much pasta recently, you're a little bit on the oily side, you know, you were in Florence, that would be a bad thing. If you, especially went up in flames, you were guilty of sin. So this was something that people did back then. And so to determine whether his visions were true and whether he really was hearing from God, so on and so forth, an ordeal by fire was arranged for Savonarola. But his enemies, the day that was supposed to take place, got a little nervous because if Savonarola comes out the other side, smoking but alive, all of a sudden this is going to give him instant mega authority, more than they could probably handle with the popular people. So they delayed the event, and while he's waiting there, he's willing to do it. He's, You give me the ordeal by fire, I'll walk through it, the Lord will bring me through it, yada, yada, yada. They finally get ready to do it, light the thing up, and a huge thunderstorm comes along and douses it. Just puts the whole thing out. And that was interpreted as in a negative fashion to Savonarola. This was his opportunity to prove his innocence, and God put the fire out. So this actually spelled his doom. People spun things back then too, and of course his enemies immediately spun it as evidence that Savonarola was guilty, and so he was tried in a court and condemned for heresy, and interestingly enough, however, was burned, which doesn't quite make any sense to me, but was burned in Florence on May 23rd, 1498. And he was, think about our time frame here. I know a lot of dates are going your direction, but keep in mind if we have a little timeline going on here, we're getting a whole lot closer to where we are today than where we were at the beginning. And so remember, if we're looking at 1517, as the beginning of the Reformation, then 1498 is only 2 decades before the beginning of the Reformation. So we're coming right up to that period of time, and so mysticism is alive and well, as is the corruption of the church, right in that period of time before the Reformation. One who lived after the Reformation, a mystic by the name of Teresa of Avila. She died in 1582. She was a Spanish mystic, also later made a doctor of the church. She was an active reformer of the Carmelites, a order that exists today, actually. Her parents were Jewish converts. Like Catherine, she claimed to have been spiritually married to Christ. She wrote a good bit, even going so far as to discuss things that we would absolutely blush to read today. Her favorite book was The Song of Solomon, if that tells you anything. An angel supposedly came and drove a spear into her abdomen at one point. As a reformer, she worked tirelessly to eradicate abuses in the Carmelites. She founded 17 new convents in Spain, and she, ladies, you'll appreciate this. She counseled women to put away womanish ways. In other words, be a man. That was what she suggested to the ladies. Julian of Norwich, 1342 to 1416, was a recluse who lived in a doorless apartment that had only two windows. And in fact, during this period of time, there were a couple of people, and not just a couple, but a few people, who quite literally would, like Julian, probably following in Julian's footsteps, would ask to be walled into the wall of a church, so that you would take a small room that had like a window looking out, and it would have a window looking into the church, but there would be no door. And you would be walled into this room, and that's where you would live until you died. And because you were always there at the church, you could always look through the window toward the altar, then you were always in the presence of God, and in the window looking out toward the world, people could come up to the window and ask advice of you. I'm not sure why, if you're living out in the world, you want to go to the dude who lives in the room for advice on how to... Me and my wife ain't getting along. Yeah, so, you know, I've been in here for 42 years. I don't have a wife, you know. So, strange things. But and then when they die, they wouldn't take them out. They just wall up the windows. And that would become their tomb. And that's where they'd be. And then people could eventually come and start visiting the walled-up tomb and get indulgences for visiting a relic or something. It's just anyways, so that's what Julian did. And she lived in a doorless apartment that had only two windows. She received revelations. Surprise, surprise, surprise. You live in a room with only two windows, you receive revelations. Yeah, well, they didn't have cable TV back then, so they had to do something. In May of 1373, she got one where God told her that she is his wife. From that, she wrote a devotional commentary in which she spoke of the motherhood of God. And these folks, as I said, were most interesting. That sort of takes us up to a point in time where I just realized the next section of my outline here is on a man about whose life I have an entire film that we could actually watch, which would probably be a good thing to do, and that is John Wycliffe. Looking at the pre-Reformation reformers and the work of God in bringing together everything that was needed to be brought together to bring about the Reformation. It was not God's will at the time of Wycliffe, at the middle and end of the 14th century, to bring about the Reformation. In fact, if we were to look at the personalities and learning of people like Wycliffe in comparison to Huss, you would think, on a human level anyways, that it would have been wiser to have someone like a Wycliffe as your chief reformer at the time of the Reformation than someone like Luther. But that simply wasn't God's purpose and God's will. There were a number of factors that had to come together to make the Reformation possible. It wasn't just personalities, but there were many, many factors that came together that allowed the Reformation to take place, and in fact, that caused it to take place without the chief people involved with it looking to make it happen. Luther was not looking to start a Reformation October 31st, 1517, when he posted those 95 theses. And in fact, if you read them, they really are very much Catholic statements. He viewed himself as a faithful son of the Church, but they started a process at that point in time that Luther had no idea what was going to happen or where it would lead to. But all those factors came together at that time and brought the Reformation into reality. So, but keep in mind the background then, the corruption of the papacy. In fact, we're going to look a little bit at this right before we get to Luther himself. But there's all these things that are going to come together, the corruption of the papacy, the existence of mysticism, the existence of scholasticism. All this stuff's going to come together, and we will see how it works within the lives of the chief individuals who are responsible for bringing about the Reformation, some of whom remained within the Roman Catholic Church. Erasmus was very important to the Reformation, but he never left the fellowship of Rome. Others, obviously, did, and so we'll be looking at that over the next period of time. Okay, any questions there? Okay, let's close with a word of prayer. Father, we do thank you for this day and for the opportunity of again considering your faithfulness to your word.